Chapter 1. The harsh sound of ion pistol shots sizzled out of the speakers to reverberate around the L.A. Galactic Security Office. They were swiftly drowned out by the screams. Commander Alec Hogan watched the screens in numb horror as the assassin left the scene of Casimir's murder behind, running along the central concourse of the Caralvo terminal, shooting as he went. Terrified passengers were throwing themselves flat or ducking down behind the railings. "Squad B is on the upper concourse," Rennie reported from her console. "They have clear line of sight." "Take him out," Hogan ordered. He watched a grainy camera image as the ion pulse from the squad's sharpshooter struck the assassin. A corona of purple sparks flared briefly, outlining the running figure. "Damn it," Hogan hissed. Two more ion pulses hit. Sparks were fountaining across the concourse, burning into walls and advertising panels. People shrieked as tendrils of static writhed over their clothing, singeing deep. Smoke alarms went off, adding their howl to the general din. "He's wearing a force field suit," Rennie exclaimed. "They can't penetrate from that range." Hogan opened the general communications icon in his virtual vision. "All squads close in on the target. Pursue until he's in open ground, then open fire. Overload that force field." As he watched the squads putting the new tactic into play, screens on every console started to flicker. In his virtual vision, red warning graphics sprang up across his interface with the station's network. "KR software has been released into the local network nodes," his E. Butler reported. "The controlling RI is attempting to clear it."
"God damn it!"
Hogan's fist thumped into his console. On the other side of the room, Senator Bernelli was rising from her seat. She looked distraught, her beautiful young face twisted by some unfathomable guilt. More camera images vanished from the screens in a maelstrom of static. Only one image of the assassin remained, taken from a roof sensor. Hogan watched him race along a ramp to platform 12A. Two Navy officers were chasing after him, 100 meters behind. Ion shots were exchanged. The image drizzled away into grey haze. A harsh groan crept out of Hogan's throat. This couldn't be happening. It was an absolute disaster. Worse, it was happening in front of the senator who'd given them their first ever real lead into the Guardians, a lead Hogan had been desperate to follow up. Hogan's virtual hand flew over icons, pulling out secure audio channels from the squads. At least the Navy's dedicated systems weren't too badly affected by the chaos. "He's on the platform! He's on the platform!" "With you, coming to 12A, through the second ramp."
"Shooting!"
"Wait!"
"No, civilians!"
"Vic, where are you?"
"There's a train coming in!"
"Vic!
For Christ's sake!"
"Fuck!"
"He jumped down!"
"Repeat, target is on the tracks!"
"He's on the tracks leading out westward!"
"Get after him!" Hogan ordered. "Rennie, who have we got outside?"
"Squad H is nearby."
She was pulling ground plans out of a handheld array that was unaffected by the chaos.
"Tarlo, are you there? Can you intercept?"
"We're on it."
Tarlo's terse comment was accompanied by the sound of thudding footsteps. Hogan was vaguely aware of the senator and her bodyguards leaving the security office. His E-butler had brought up a translucent 3D map of the Caralvo terminal into his virtual vision. The westbound track from Platform 12A slid out into a broad area of 100 criss-crossing tracks, a major junction zone between the passenger terminal and a cargo yard, which eventually curved around toward the cliff of Gateways 5 kilometers to the north.
"He'll never make it there," Hogan muttered.
He turned to Tulloch, the CST security liaison officer.
"Are any of your teams outside?"
The man nodded.
"Three teams. They're converging now. This chaos doesn't help, but they've got clean communications. Don't worry, we'll seal him up inside that junction. He's not going anywhere."
Hogan looked around the security office again, seeing his people glaring in frustration at their useless consoles. All they could do was wait until the RI purged the station network. Down on the ground, teams were calling out coordinates to one another. His inserts were assigning them places on the map. It was a wide circle surrounding the western track of Platform 12A, a very loose circle. Rennie was issuing a stream of orders, trying to close the gaps.
"I'm going down there," Hogan announced.
"Sir?" Rennie broke off from the tactical situation to give him a surprised glance. "Take over here," he told her. "I might be able to help down there." He saw the brief flicker of doubt on her face before she said, "Yes, sir." Hogan was all too aware of how widespread that uncertainty had become among the officers under his command. The Paris office he'd inherited from Paul Amayo had never considered him anything other than Admiral Columbia's placeman, a political appointee who wasn't really up to the job. At the start of this observation operation, he'd hoped he might finally gain their respect. Now that hope, too, seemed to be vanishing along with the assassin. The chaos that was wreaking electronic havoc on L.A. Galactic was starting to be felt on a physical level. Hogan had to use the stairs at the end of the Coralvo office block to get down to the concourse. The safety system on every elevator in the building had tripped, halting them wherever they were in the shafts. He dashed down the four flights of stairs from the security office, arriving on the ground floor, only mildly out of breath. Out on the concourse, a tide of panicked people was buzzing around in disarray. Frightened by the murder and the chase, confused by the collapse of the local network, they didn't know which way to flee. It didn't help that almost every alarm was now sounding, and scarlet holographic arrows indicating the emergency exits were sliding through the air above them in contradictory directions. Hogan pushed through them, oblivious to the curses they hurled at him. He was listening to the squads on the secure communications channels. It wasn't sounding good. There were too many queries, too many of them shouting, "Which way?" They were all too reliant on the officers up in the security office coordinating the operation, arranging them into neat sweep patterns, watching the situation through the station's primary sensors. "Have to change training procedures," he thought absently. His map showed the ragged circle of his officers and the SCT teams closing slowly on the assassin's supposed position. He pulled out his own ion pistol as he charged up the ramp to Platform 12A. The few passengers left were all curled up next to walls and pillars. They flinched as he sprinted past and dropped down onto the track. Bold amber holograms at the edge of the platform warned him not to proceed any farther. He ignored them and raced toward the end of the terminal, where the sunlight streamed down past the high arching roof. Rennie's voice was still calm and level in his ears as she told people where to turn, what direction to take. Despite that, there were still big gaps in the noose contracting around the assassin. Hogan clenched his jaw and said nothing, but he was furious with their ragged deployment. It was only when he emerged into the flood of California sunlight that he saw the reason. The whole junction area represented on his virtual map, so neatly laced with various tracks, was in reality a harsh environment of concrete and steel sprawling for kilometers in every direction. Along one side were the bulky warehouses and loading gantries of the cargo yard, where machines and bots were in constant motion. But ahead of him, dozens of trains were winding their way across the junction, from ponderous kilometre-long freighters pulled along by huge GH-9 engines to trans-Earth loop trains. 20-wagon intrastation goods shunters, as well as the sleek white express trains chasing past at frighteningly high speed. They filled the air with metallic screeching and a thunderous rattling, a constant racket that was overlaid by the clunks and clangs of what must have been small ships colliding. It was a noise he had always been oblivious to as he rode in the conditioned comfort of the first-class passenger carriages. The chaos attack made no impact on the station's traffic control. CST, ever anxious about sabotage or even natural catastrophe, used independent, ultra-hardened encryption to maintain full communications with and control of the trains at all times and under any circumstances. They'd even prevailed during the alien assault on the Lost 23. Hogan almost skidded to a halt as a fast cargo train sped past 50 meters to his left. He could feel the wind of its slipstream on his face. Several squad members were visible, spread out in the distance ahead of him, all of them holding their weapons ready, trying to look in every direction at once. Hogan touched the virtual icon that put him in direct contact with Tulloch.
"For Christ's sake, shut down the traffic out here! We're going to get pulped into the landscape!"
"Sorry, Alec. I've already tried. Transport Control won't do it without executive-level authority."
"Shit!"
As Hogan watched, one of his people suddenly sprinted sideways. A 200-meter-long snake of tanker trucks hauled by a GH-4 engine trundled along the line he'd been standing on.
"Rennie, get Admiral Columbia to set off a nuke under CST. I want these goddamn trains shut down.
Now!"
"Working on it, sir. The chaos is being flushed. Should have full sensor coverage back in a few minutes."
"Christ!"
He spat under his breath. "Just how many disasters can you pile up in one day?" He hurriedly sidestepped off the actual track itself and began jogging toward the erratic line of squad members up ahead.
"Okay, people, let's get more organized. Who was the last person to actually see our target?"
"Couple of minutes ago. He was 200 meters ahead of me, heading northwest."
Hogan's virtual vision identified the speaker as John King and tagged his position on the map.
"Positive sighting, sir. I've got him on the other side of this flatbed shunter,"
Gwyneth Russell said. Her location was nearly half a kilometer away from John's.
"When?"
Hogan demanded.
"He jumped behind it maybe a minute ago, sir."
"I can confirm that," Tarlo said. "My squad is due north of Gwyneth. The flatbed shunter has just reached us. He's on the other side of it."
Hogan scanned the direction his map indicated Tarlo's squad was deployed. A fast-moving train of cylindrical containers was zipping along a rail between him and the squad. He thought he could see another train moving on the other side of it, through the gaps between the containers. Might have been the flatbed shunter. It was a confusing flicker of motion. There was a brief ebb to the background clamour, and he heard a high-pitched humming from the concave gully on his right-hand side, the sound of high-voltage cables. Hogan looked down at it, frowning. He'd assumed it was a long, enzyme-bonded concrete storm drain of some kind, about 3 meters wide and one deep. The grey surface was rippling slightly, and the entire gully behind him moved across the ground, linking up to another gully running parallel to it 20 meters away. Maglev track. Hogan flung himself down onto the hard granite chippings and put his hands over his head. An express train hurtled past, its slipstream howling. His uniform jacket flapped around like a sail in a tornado. For an instant, he thought the air pressure was going to be strong enough to lift him off the ground. He shouted wordlessly into the bone-shaker yowl as animal fear surged through him. Then the express was gone, its rear strobe light blinking into the distance. It took a minute for his legs to stop shaking enough to carry his weight. He clambered slowly to his feet, looking nervously along the innocuous gully for any sign of another express.
"He's not here," Tarlo called. "Sir, we missed him."
Hogan's map showed a big concentration of squad members along a section of track, with Tarlo in the middle.
"We can't have," Gwyneth insisted. "For God's sake, I saw him behind the train."
"Well, he didn't come this way."
"Then where, for fuck's sake?"
"Can anyone see him?"
Hogan asked.
"Somebody?"
He received a chorus of,
"Not here. No, sir."
As he walked unsteadily away from the maglev track, his virtual vision showed him the station network slowly re-establishing itself. Rennie had pulled a junction routing schedule from traffic control and was using it to warn everybody of approaching trains.
"Keep everyone in their positions," he told her. "I want a perimeter around this junction. He can't have reached the edges yet. We keep it sealed until we have full electronic coverage again.
Yes, sir, she answered.
Oh,
we just got some additional help. A couple of black helicopters swooped low over the junction with LAPD written in white on their underbelly. Hogan glared at them.
Oh, great. Just like the Marina fiasco.
The cops will be laughing their asses off at us. Clear sensor images were flipping up into a grid in his virtual vision as the chaos cleared. He heard the first of the trains braking, a teeth-jangling screech that cut clean across the junction. It was joined by another, then another, until every train was slowing to a halt. Finally, the junction was silent, the trains motionless.
All right, people,
Hogan announced grimly.
Let's sweep this area, sector by sector.
2 hours later, Alec had to admit defeat. They'd searched every inch of the junction, visually and with sensors. The assassin was nowhere to be found. The perimeter of his own squads and CST security teams remained unbreached. Yet the target had somehow eluded them. From his makeshift field command post on Platform 12A, Hogan watched the tired, despondent squads trekking in from all across the junction. It was a wretched blow to everyone's morale. He could see it in their expressions, the way they wouldn't meet his eyes as they passed. Tarlow stopped in front of him, looking more angry than disappointed.
I don't get it. We were right behind him. The others were all around. There's no way he could have got past us. I don't care what he was wet-wired with.
He had help, Hogan told his lieutenant. A lot of help.
The chaos alone proves that.
Yeah, I guess. You coming back to Paris? Some of us are going to hit the bars. They'll still be open. The good ones, anyway.
At any other time, Hogan would have appreciated the offer.
Thanks, but no. I've got to tell the Admiral what happened.
Tarlow winced in sympathy.
Ouch. Well, that's why they pay you the big bucks.
Not enough for this,
Hogan muttered as the tall Californian headed off down the platform to his squadmates. He took a breath and told his e-butler to place the call to Columbia's office. Senator Justine Bernelli stayed with the body as the official from the city morgue directed the robotic stretcher toward one of Caralvo's many basement service exits. There had been quite a delay while L.A. Galactic recovered from its chaos attack, time she simply spent staring at Casimir's figure on the white marble floor of the concourse. The sheet that the subdued CST staff had produced wasn't quite big enough to cover the pool of blood spreading around him. Now her love was sealed in a black body bag, and a small squadron of cleaning bots was already at work on the blood, scarring the marble surface, eradicating any sign of staining with sharp, effective chemicals. In a week's time, nobody would ever know what happened on that spot. The robotic stretcher slid itself into the back of the morgue ambulance.
I'll ride with him, Justine announced.
Nobody argued, not even Paula Mayo. Justine clambered into the vehicle and sat on the cramped bench beside the stretcher as the doors closed. Mayo and the two Senate security bodyguards she had detailed to accompany Justine got into a waiting car behind the ambulance. Alone in the gloomy light from a single polyphoto strip on the ceiling, Justine thought she was going to start crying again.
I won't. Casimir wouldn't want that. Him and his old-world notions.
A lone tear leaked down her cheek as she slowly unzipped the body bag, allowing herself to see him one last time before the inevitable forensic autopsy. His young body would be examined and analyzed very thoroughly, which would mean the pathologists cutting him open to complement the deep scan. He wouldn't be Casimir after that. She gazed down at him, still surprised by the passive expression on his face.
Oh, my love. I'll carry on your cause, she promised him. I'll fight your fight, and we'll win. We'll beat it. We'll destroy the Starflyer.
Casimir's dead face stared up blindly. She flinched as she looked down at his ruined chest, the tattered burnt hole that the ion pulse had left in his jacket and shirt. Slowly she forced her hand into his pockets,
feeling around for anything. He'd been sent to the observatory in Peru to collect something, and she knew she couldn't trust the Navy. She wasn't sure about Mayo, either, and the investigator certainly didn't trust her. There was nothing in his pockets. She moved down his body, patting the fabric of his clothes, trying to ignore the smears of blood building up on her fingers and palms. It took a while, but she eventually found the memory crystal in his belt. A faint, fond smile touched her lips at that. Casimir, on his secret mission, used a belt-secure pocket, like some tourist afraid of being mugged. There and then she hated the Guardians for using him. Their cause might be right, but that didn't mean they could recruit children. Justine was wiping her hands down on some tissues when the vehicle started braking to a halt. She shoved the tissues into her bag along with the memory crystal and hurriedly zipped the body bag up. The doors opened. Justine stepped out, worried she would look as guilty as she felt. They were in a small warehouse, packed on a platform beside a waiting train that had only two carriages. She'd had to call Campbell Sheldon to summon up a private train so quickly. Fortunately, he'd been sympathetic. Even though they were friends, she knew there would be a price to pay later. There always was, some support for a policy, a returned favor. It was the way of the game. She didn't care. Paula stood beside her as the stretcher trundled into the cargo compartment on the second carriage.
"You realize that Admiral Columbia will not approve of this, Senator."
"I know," Justine said. She didn't care about that either. "But I want to be very sure of the autopsy. Senate security can supervise the procedure, but I want it performed at our family clinic in New York. It's the only place I can be sure there will be no discrepancies or problems."
"I understand."
The train took 20 minutes to traverse the distance between Seattle and the Newark station, which served New York. An unmarked ambulance from the clinic was waiting for the body, along with two limousines. This time Justine couldn't avoid riding with Paula as the little convoy sped off to the exclusive facility just outside the city.
"Do you trust me?" Paula asked.
Justine pretended to look out of the darkened window at the outlying districts. Despite the profound shock of the murder and all its associated emotional turmoil, she was still rational enough to consider the implications of the question. And she knew damn well the investigator never ever eased off.
"I believe we now share several common goals.
We both want that assassin caught. We both believe the Starflyer exists. We both certainly know the Navy is compromised."
"That will do to begin with," Paula said.
"You still have blood under your fingernails, Senator. I presume it got there when you searched the body." Justine knew her cheeks would be reddening. So much for slick maneuvering. She gave the investigator a long, calculating look, then reached down into her bag for another tissue.
"Did you find anything?" Paula asked.
"Do you still think the Starflyer got to me when I was on Far Away?"
"Nothing in this case can be certain. The Starflyer has had a very long time to establish its connections within the Commonwealth unopposed and unseen. But I do assign that a very low probability."
"I'm on probation, then." Justine worked the tissue edge at a fleck of blood on her left index finger.
"An astute summary.
It must be very lonely for you up there on top of Olympus, judging the rest of us. I hadn't realized how badly you've been affected by McFoster's death. I wouldn't normally expect a Bernelli to give away any edge in a deal."
"Are we making a deal?"
"You know we are. Casimir and I were lovers." She said it simply, as if it were a stock market report, trying to keep her distance. Inside, the numbness was giving way to pain. She knew once the body was delivered safely to the clinic, she'd have to flee back to the Tulip Mansion, a place where she could grieve properly without anyone seeing.
"I had determined that much. Did you meet on Far Away?"
"Yes. He was only 17 then. I'd never have guessed I could love someone like that. But then you never get to choose when it comes to real love, do you?"
"No."
Paula turned away. "Have you been in love like that, investigator?"
Love that makes you completely crazy? Not for several lives. No. I could cope with a body loss. I have with my brother. I could even cope with him losing several days of memory. But this is death, Investigator. Casimir is gone forever, and I am the cause of that. I am the one who betrayed him. I'm not equipped for that, not mentally. True death is not something that happens today. Mistakes of this magnitude cannot be buried. The Prime attack resulted in several tens of millions of humans being killed on the Lost 23. People who will never be relived. Your grief is not unique. Not anymore.
I'm just another rich bitch who has lost a trinket. Is that it?
No, Senator. Your suffering is very real, and for that I am genuinely sympathetic. However, I do believe you will get through this. You have determination and clarity of thought that is only afforded to people of your age and experience. Justine snorted.
Emotional scar tissue, you mean?
Resilience would be closer to the mark.
If anything,
I'd say today has shown you just how human you are. In that, at least, you can be content. Justine finished polishing her nails with the tissue. Now there was no evidence she had ever touched him. It was a miserable thought.
You really believe that?
I do. I'm assuming the body is actually being taken to your family clinic so you can clone him?
No.
I won't do that to him. Replicating him physically is hardly going to purge my guilt. A person is more than just a body. I'm going to give Casimir the one gift I still can. I can do no less.
I see.
Then I wish you happiness in your choice, Senator.
Thank you.
But I would still like to know if you found anything. A memory, Crystal.
May I see it?
Yes. I suppose you can. It's your experience I'll need to help bring down the Starflyer. But there are limits to my cooperation. I won't give the Navy anything that will help them stop the Guardians. I don't care how committed you are to arresting Johansson.
I understand.
Adam had personally given Kieran McSobel the support assignment for Casimir's run. Kieran had been making good progress since arriving on Earth a few years earlier, absorbing their tradecraft with ease, staying cool under pressure, qualities that marked him as highly suitable for the kind of operations the Guardians were performing these days. This assignment should be a walk in the park for him. When Casimir's loop train pulled in, Kieran was in place on the Caralvo's concourse, mingling with the perpetual flood of passengers. Indistinguishable in the crowd, like any good operative, ready for any number of contingencies. Away on the other side of the station complex, the Guardians monitored his progress from the offices of Lemuel's Max Transit Company. Adam himself lounged against the back wall, watching them in turn. He didn't interfere with the procedures. After all, they were the ones he'd taught them, but he wanted his presence to supply them with a degree of reassurance. A comfortable father figure. It took a lot of effort not to pull a dismayed face every time he thought that. But this was a crucial operation. He had to be here to keep an eye on it. Bradley Johansson was desperate for the Martian data. The alien attack on the edge of Phase 2 space had played hell with their carefully plotted timetable. Marisa McFoster was running electronic scans through the Caralvo's network, searching for any sign of observation activity around Casimir.
"It's clean," she announced. A secure link connected her to Kieran. "Proceed," she told him.
A map on one of her console screens showed Kieran's icon moving slowly along the concourse toward the main exit. He ought to be 30 meters behind Casimir, monitoring the throng of passengers for possible tails.
"He stopped," Kieran said suddenly.
"What do you mean, stopped?"
Marisa asked. Adam immediately straightened up.
"Please, not again."
"He's shouting at someone,"
Kieran's puzzled voice said.
"What in the dreaming heavens?"
"Give me a visual," Marisa told him. Adam hurried over to stand behind her chair, bending to look at her console portal. The link from Kieran's retinal inserts delivered an unsteady picture, a poor view through a crowd of people.
A cluster of dark, out-of-focus heads bobbed around directly in front of him. On the other side of them, a figure was running. The image flared white as an ion pulse discharged.
Fuck!
Kieran yelled. Smeared strands of darkness slashed across the glare of light as he whipped his head about. For a second, there was a blurry, black-and-white image of a man flying backward through the air, arms and legs flung wide. Then Kieran zoomed in on the man with the gun, who was now turning to run.
Bruce!
Marisa cried out.
Who the hell's Bruce?
Adam demanded. Bruce McFoster. Casimir's friend.
Shit! You mean the one that was killed?
Yeah.
Adam slapped a fist against his forehead. Only he wasn't. The Starflyer's done this to your prisoners before.
God damn it!
The screen showing the feed from Kieran flashed white.
He's shooting again,
Kieran said. All the portal showed now was a pair of shoes, their wearer lying flat on a white marble floor. Kieran lifted his head, and the shoes sank off the bottom of the portal. Beyond them, Bruce McFoster was racing down the concourse, people ducking for cover on either side of him as he kept on firing. Two men and one woman were chasing after him, holding pistols and yelling at him to stop. They were dressed in ordinary clothes.
They aren't CST security, Adam said grimly.
A shot from somewhere above and behind Kieran struck Bruce McFoster. His force field flared briefly, but he never slowed.
Dear God, how many people knew Casimir was on this run?
Red icons started to flash up across Marisa's console.
Someone's attacked the local network with chaos, she said. Bad strike. This is high-grade software. The RI can barely contain the contamination.
That'll be Bruce or his controllers, Adam said.
It'll help him get clear.
They must have known the Navy was watching Casimir.
Which is more than we did, he thought miserably. The link to Kieran's inserts was dissolving. All that remained was his secured audio channel.
What do we do?
Marisa asked.
Kieran, can you reach Casimir?
Adam demanded.
Can you retrieve the memory crystal? I don't... Oh, what? There's someone... armed. Standing beside... That's no way... I can't get... more people... Alarms triggered.
All right. Stay put and see what happens.
See where they take him.
I'm on.
Okay. Can you see where Bruce has gone? Shooting, Stell. Chase. Platform 12A. Pursuit. Repeat. Platform 12A.
Adam didn't even need to consult a console map. After 25 years working in LA Galactic, he knew the massive station's layout better than Nigel Sheldon. He sat at the console beside Marisa and opened the dedicated landlines he'd carefully installed over the last few years, using bots to spool out optical cable through ducts and along pipes, spreading their invisible web across the massive station's landscape. Each one was connected to a tiny, stealthed sensor. They'd been placed on walls high above the ground, lampposts, bridges, anywhere that provided a good field of view. Two of them covered the large junction area west of the Caralvo. The images came up just in time for Adam to see Bruce sprinting out from under the huge, arching concrete roof that covered the platform. The Starflyer agent turned sharply and began leaping over tracks. Adam actually drew in a sharp breath at one point as a train hurtled toward the speeding figure. But Bruce cut clean in front of it with perfect timing. He ran past a second train that was traveling more slowly and in the opposite direction. It completely threw the Navy personnel following him. CST security staff were drifting into the images, jogging along dangerously close to trains as they tried to look past the flashing wheels. Adam suddenly realized that none of them had any contact with traffic control. Bruce jumped over a maglev track and changed direction yet again. His pursuers were slowing now. They'd become wary of the trains rushing through the junction, switching tracks without warning. Despite their caution, they were deployed in a simple circle that was slowly contracting. Adam knew they must have access to some kind of communications. He ordered a sensor to focus on one of the Navy personnel. Sure enough, the woman was emitting a faint electromagnetic micropulse well outside the standard civil cybersphere node spectrum. They were using a dedicated high-order encryption system to keep in contact.
Damn it,
Adam whispered to himself. No wonder his team's scrutineer programs, so carefully infiltrated into LA Galactic's network nodes, hadn't spotted any surveillance around Casimir, which meant Navy intelligence suspected their counter-surveillance capabilities. That, or Alec Hogan, was being seriously paranoid. One of the Navy people was closing on Bruce along a narrow corridor formed by two moving trains. They were only a couple of hundred meters apart. Bruce seemed oblivious to his pursuer.
Paula Mayo,
Kieran said.
Repeat, please, Adam told him quickly. I see Mayo. Concourse. Charge. Talking. The senator.
Paula Mayo. Not off the case after all.
Damn it.
It was a tiny distraction, but enough for Adam to lose sight of Bruce down amid the tracks and speeding trains.
Where the hell did he go?
It looked like the pursuers didn't have a clue either. A whole line of them was now walking along the track where he'd been moments ago, shouting at one another and waving their hands about. The trains were coming to a halt all around them. It took three replays of the sensor recordings before Adam was really certain. He watched the enhanced image of Bruce in slow motion, a collection of blurred grey pixels that made a crazy jump straight at a freight train as it slid alongside. A dark square on the side of a freight container swallowed up the smudged figure. Seconds later, the square had vanished, closing up into an ordinary sheet of metal.
Son of a bitch,
Adam grunted.
We're up against a real bunch of Boy Scouts here.
Sir? Marisa asked.
They came very well prepared.
4 centuries of experience and objectivity counted for absolutely nothing as the Pathfinder began its terrifying plummet. Ozzy started screaming as loudly as Orion, both of them audible even over the thunder of the falling sea. Spray whirled around the rickety raft with brutal force, wiping out all sight of the sky in a grey haze. Ozzy clung to the mast as if that alone could save him from certain death as he fell and fell and fell without end. The spume soaked his clothes in seconds, stinging his naked skin. He drew a breath and screamed again. When he ran out of air, he sucked down more, half of which was fizzing water. He coughed and spluttered, an automatic action that overrode the wild impulse to keep on screaming. As soon as his throat was clear and his lungs full again, he started to open his mouth for the scream that would surely end in an awful explosion of pain. Right at the back of his brain, an insecure, puzzled thought began to register. As they went over the edge of the waterfall, he'd glimpsed the impossible length of the cascade, and there hadn't been a bottom. No jagged rocks below upon which to smash apart. No abrupt end. Nothing, in fact. The whole setup is artificial, you asshole. Ozzy took another breath, exhaled through flared nostrils, then forced himself to inhale deeply. His body insisted he was falling, and had been doing so for several seconds now. Animal instinct knew they must have hurtled down an incredible distance, that his velocity was way past terminal already. The steady breathing routine helped slow his frantic heart rate.
Think. You're not falling, you're in zero G. Free fall.
You're safe. For the moment, anyway.
The roar of the waterfall somewhere beyond the lashing froth was still overwhelming. He could hear Orion's cries that had become gulping whimpers. Wiping the droplets from his eyes, he peered around. The boy was clinging to the deck of the raft a couple of meters away. The naked terror on his face was horrible to see. Nobody should have to suffer like that.
It's okay,
Ozzy bellowed.
We're not falling. It just looks like it. We're in free fall, like astronauts.
That should reassure the boy. Orion's horror took on a bamboozled aspect.
What knots?
Oh, for Christ's sake. We're safe. Okay? It's not as bad as it looks.
The boy nodded his head, totally unconvinced. He was still bracing himself for the certain killer impact. Ozzy took a good look around, constantly having to wipe the spray from his face.
He could just pick out the sun, a smear of brightness creating a whorl of refraction rainbows within the spray.
Call that direction up, then. Half of the saturated universe surrounding them was distinctly darker than the other half. That must be the waterfall. Which was wrong, because if they were truly in zero-G, the water wouldn't fall anywhere. Yet he'd seen it. He tightened his grip on the mast with an involuntary lurch. Okay, so what can cause water to flow in zero-G? Fuck knows. So what geometry is this screwball worldlet? It can't be a planet. He remembered the water specks drifting through the hazy, eternal sky of the gas halo. This colossal worldlet must be one of them. As always in this place, scale had thrown him. A flat ocean on one side, then, with the water falling off the edge. If it pours away constantly, then it will have to be replaced. Or more likely, it just cycles around and around. The underside collects the overspill somehow and sends it back to the ocean side again. Crazy. But then if you can create gravity and apply it how you want, it isn't actually so weird. With controllable gravity as a baseline, Ozzy tried to picture the geometry of the worldlet. If it was truly like the other water specks, then it was completely covered in water. Gravity projectors just pulled the fluid around in unexpected directions. He didn't like the shapes his mind was coming up with. None of them had undersides where the raft could float along serenely. When he looked around again, he thought they were drifting closer toward the waterfall. The spray around them was noticeably thinner, yet the gloom was no darker. They must be moving into the underside shadow.
There is gravity here, at right angles to the ocean on the top side. Maybe even less than 90 degrees, because the water has to be pulled around and under, which is really not good. We cannot afford to get caught up in the flow. For now, they were safe, as long as the underside gravity was still tenuous.
The ocean current had shot them horizontally past the edge of the worldlet, which had given them a hiatus, but the underside's artificial gravity would pull them in eventually. It was already attracting the spray droplets, drawing them back into the flow. They had to get clear while the gravity remained weak, and he could only think of one propulsive force left to them. Ozzy checked that the rope around his waist was tied very securely to the base of the mast and let go. Orion squealed in shock, his wide eyes following Ozzy's every move. It had been a long time since Ozzy had been in freefall. Even then, he'd never been particularly good at maneuvering around. He pushed lightly against the mast, remembering the cardinal rule that you must never move quickly. There were objects gliding through the spray around him, mostly the globes of fruit they'd brought with them, which had escaped from their wicker baskets. His little shaving pack tumbled past him, and he cursed, unreasonably annoyed at the utterly trivial loss. Thankfully, the handheld array was still clipped to his rucksack, which was lashed firmly to the deck. He pulled the glistening gadget free and hauled his way across the Pathfinder until he reached Tochi. The wooden decking where the big alien was clinging on with its locomotion flesh ridges was bent upward, its grip was so fierce. Some of the crudely shaped branches were actually starting to fracture. Ozzy held on to a single branch of decking and pushed the array in front of Tochi's protuberant eye.
"We have to get out of here!"
Ozzy cried. The array translated his voice into dancing violet starbursts on its screen.
"We fall to our death," Tochi replied through the array. "I regret this. I wish for more life." "I don't have time to explain," Ozzy replied.
He was aware the waterfall's rumble was reducing as the cascade slowly calmed.
"Trust me, please. You have to fly us out of here."
Friend Ozzy, I cannot fly. I am sorry.
Yes, you can. Swim, Tochi, swim in the air. That should pull us free. We must not touch the water again.
I do not understand.
No time. Trust me. I'll hold you. You swim. Away from the waterfall. As hard as you can.
Ozzy clambered clumsily along Tochi's body. The alien's natural cloak of colorful feather-like fronds was saturated, sticking to its leathery hide. They felt soggy under his skin, and he didn't dare pull too hard on one in case it ripped off. Finally, he was behind Tochi's rump and put his arms out to grip the alien's locomotion flesh ridges. He felt the rubbery tissue slither under his fingers as Bud swelled over his hands, forming an unbreakable hold. Tochi tensed for a long moment, then abruptly let go of the Pathfinder. It spread all four of its flesh ridges onto wide fins, which began to ripple tentatively. Ozzy felt the rope tighten around his waist. Then, as Tochi began to beat his fins with larger, more positive sweeps, the tension in the rope increased. If he'd thought about just how much the raft massed, Ozzy might have come up with a slightly different method of Tochi pulling them free. As it was, he was the critical link in the chain. With Tochi's vigorous forward motion towing them away from the underside's diminutive gravity field, the entire raft was very literally dangling from Ozzy's waist. He gritted his teeth as the force on his arms increased. Now that Tochi could see the effect it was having, its enthusiasm had grown. There was actually a sudden wind gusting back from its fins. The big creature began to change them further, thinning its flesh out so they became more wing-like. Ozzy just knew his arms were going to pull clean out of their shoulder sockets any minute now. He never knew exactly how long it took, but eventually the spray reduced down to an insipid mist. That, too, cleared. They left the waterfall's cloak of mist behind, emerging out into direct sunlight. Bright blue sky materialized around them, its warmth sinking into his skin. The noise of the waterfall had become a background growling. It didn't threaten anymore. Tochi stopped flapping and pulled its sinuous flesh back down into the usual ridges along its flanks. Ozzy felt a slow tremor run the length of his friend's big body. When he looked down between his legs, he could see they were drifting in toward the raft. Orion's bewildered, hopeful face looked up at them. The rope was already slack, bending into supple loops that snaked around through the air. They just missed being impaled on the top of the mast and sank down to the decking. Tochi extended a slim tentacle and coiled its tip around a branch. The locomotion ridge flesh smothering Ozzy's hands retracted, and he grabbed at the mast. His heart was thudding away inside his ribs.
"What's happening?"
Orion demanded. The boy still hadn't let go of the decking where he'd been tied.
"Why aren't we dead?"
Ozzy opened his mouth and gave a loud burp. Now he had a moment. He could feel his stomach rebelling against the ceaseless falling sensation. On top of that discomfort, his head felt as if he'd suddenly come down with a cold, with his sinuses badly clogged.
"We're not falling in the normal sense," Ozzy said slowly.
He was aware of Tochi's body aligning its eyes on the handheld array, where the alien was avidly reading the spiky purple patterns flowering on the screen. And that wasn't a normal planet. He pointed tentatively back at the gigantic waterfall. It formed an awesome curtain of glistening motion beyond the port side of the raft, extending away out to a vanishing point in three directions. Only the rim of the worldlet provided an end. And that seemed to be receding gently. The Pathfinder had actually descended several kilometers below the level of the ocean. There the water foamed and frothed wildly as it poured out over the edge, while behind them it was now considerably more placid as its gargantuan writhing cataracts and spume merged back into a single rippling torrent that surged along the cliff that comprised the side of the synthetic worldlet. Following the water as it flowed along, he couldn't see where it was heading, not even with his retinal inserts on full zoom. Right at the limit of resolution, the cliff appeared to be curving away. If he was right about that, it would make the worldlet hemispherical. Directly above them, the brim of the worldlet was definitely curved, although it was a very slight curve. His inserts ran a few calculations. If the topside was truly circular, it would be just over 1,600 kilometers in diameter. He whistled appreciatively.
"I think I'm going to be sick," Orion said miserably.
"Listen, man,"
Ozzy said. "I know you feel this is the strangest sensation, and I really appreciate it looks even worse, but the human body can live in these conditions. Astronauts were floating around in space for months at a time when I was your age."
"I don't know any astronauts," Orion wailed glumly. "I never heard of aliens called that."
Ozzy wanted to drop his head into his hands, but that would have required gravity.
"I am not certain that my body can survive either," Tochi said through the array. "I feel considerable discomfort. I do not understand why I think I am falling. I can see I am not, yet that is not what my senses tell me."
"I know it's difficult at first," Ozzy said. "But trust me on this one, guys. Your bodies will get used to it in a little while. If experience is anything to go by, you'll probably even get to like it."
He stopped as Orion made a miserable retching sound. Then the boy was vomiting weakly.
"I would like to believe you, my friend Ozzy," Tochi said. "But I do not believe that you understand my physiology well enough to make such a statement."
Orion wiped his hand over his mouth, then stared in disgust at the sticky yellow globules that oscillated slowly through the air just in front of his face.
"We can't stay here," he exclaimed desolately. "Tochi, can you pull us back to the island?"
"I should be able to."
"Whoa there, guys," Ozzy said. "Let's not rush into actions like that. If we fly over that ocean and the gravity catches us, we're likely to fall for real."
"It's got to be better than this,"
Orion whined. His cheeks bulged again and he groaned. Ozzy looked back at the worldlet. They were definitely drifting away from it at a slow but steady rate. "There are other objects inside the gas halo. Remember what Bradley Johansson told me? He wound up on some sort of tree reef that lives in orbit here. And they categorically have paths away. I mean, how else would he get back to the Commonwealth?"
"Are they far?"
Orion moaned.
"I don't know,"
Ozzy said patiently. "We'll have to wait and see what we find next." He held his hand out. "There's a breeze here. That means we're moving." He realized the raft had twisted so that the worldlet was slipping below the decking.
"I really hate this," Orion said.
"I know. Now let's get everything as secure as we can. We can't risk losing any more supplies. Or any of us, for that matter."
The designers of the Tulip Mansion had intended the conservatory-style chamber to be the breakfast room. It extended out from the eastern side of the north wing like an octagonal blister, traditional high glass roof supported by cast-iron pillars and walls made of gently curving panes that came down to ground level. The floor was classic black and white marble tiles, with a large central circular Romanate bar where the pampered owners ate their morning meal amid dappled beams of strong sunlight. Vines and climbing fuchsias grew out of big unglazed pots at the foot of each pillar, their shaggy greenery providing a gentle shade. The air had a sweet muskiness, complemented during the day by the delicate scent of the short-lived flowers that bloomed all the year. With the Bernelli family preferring the less exposed West Wing dining room to start the day in, Justine had taken over the chamber as a kind of casual office. Out had come the formal chairs to be replaced by some large leather couches and even a couple of gel-mold bags. The only thing standing on the central bar these days was a giant crescent-shaped aquarium with a variety of colourful terrestrial and alien fish that regarded one another warily. It left just enough room for the two technicians to install the new large array on the remaining surface. Justine stood in the doorway, watching as they completed their checks and gathered up their tools. She was wearing black, of course, a plain long skirt and matching blouse. Nothing too fashionable, but not gloomy either. Just a simple statement, which she felt was most appropriate. Most of her social circle wouldn't even recognize the significance, she thought. Their kind never had to deal with the concept of death anymore. Up and running, ma'am, the senior technician said.
Thank you,
Justine said distantly. The two technicians nodded politely and left. They were from Dislan, the Benelli-owned electronics company that did nothing but manufacture and supply equipment to the family. She went over to the austere silver-grey cylinder squatting on the polished granite top bar. There was a tiny light on the upper rim, gleaming scarlet. Paula Mayo walked into the chamber and shut the tall double doors behind her.
"Is this secure, Senator?"
she asked. There was a degree of scepticism in the tone as she glanced out through the wide windows. Beyond the rose gardens, the hills of Rye County formed a crumpled landscape of pine forests, broken by the deeper green swaths of rhododendron bushes that had long finished flowering. Justine gave her e-butler an instruction. The walls and roof dissolved into a grainy curtain of grey light, like a hologram projector showing a drab autumn sky. No hint of the external world remained, an effect that produced a near claustrophobic feeling.
"It is now,"
Justine said lightly, "and the array is completely independent. It doesn't even have a node, so nobody can hack in. We're as isolated as it's possible to be in the modern world." She took the memory crystal from a slim metal case and stood in front of the array. The single light turned from scarlet to emerald as she pressed her hand on the top.
"I want you to scan this, and tell me what data it contains."
"Yes, Senator," the R.I. replied. A small circle on top of the cylinder dilated, and Justine dropped the memory crystal in.
"It's a quantum scanner," she told Paula, "so it should be able to locate any hardwired ambush in the molecular structure."
The two of them sat on one of the couches. Its brown leather was so parched from the strong sunlight it was cracking open. Justine enjoyed it, for that, as much as the softness that came from age. A tatty piece of furniture in a trillionaire's immaculate household also made the chamber more appealing to her, a little stamp of personal identity.
"What happened at the autopsy?"
Justine asked.
"It was all very ordinary,"
Paula said.
"They confirmed a lack of any memory cell insert. The rest of his inserts were all relatively common. Navy intelligence will track down the manufacturer, and from that we should get the clinic which gave them to Casimir. I expect the operation will have been paid for either with cash or from a one-time account. Adam Elvin doesn't make elementary mistakes, but they could get lucky."
"Is that it?" Justine wasn't sure what she'd expected, something that made him stand out, at least, an aspect that proved how exceptional he was.
"Essentially, yes. Cause of death confirmed as the ion shot. He wasn't taking any narcotics, although there was evidence of heavy steroid and hormone infusions over the last couple of years, which is understandable for someone born on a low-gravity world.
You should know. He hadn't undergone any cellular reprofiling." Justine gave the investigator a frown.
"It really was him," Paula explained. "They weren't trying to push a ringer on you."
"Ah." She could have told the investigator that. He was Casimir. Nobody could fake that.
"What about his hotel room? Any leads there?"
"It doesn't look like it. I'm receiving the reports directly from Navy Intelligence as soon as they're filed in their database. Of course, if there's anything they're not filing, that they're keeping to themselves, then we have a problem."
"Is that likely?"
"It's a remote possibility.
Legally, they have to put everything on file, and therefore Senate security has complete access, as we are higher up the security service food chain. However, you and I both know that the Navy is compromised. One of the Starflyer's people could be holding things back. Assuming they're not, will the hotel room tell us much? Not really. The Guardians seem to be as thorough with their tradecraft in their own homes as they are everywhere else. The only report I really value is Casimir's financial record. That should give us a nice breakdown of his movements before you alerted the Navy to his presence. A fresh burst of guilt at the reminder made Justine tighten her jaw muscles. When will that be ready? A couple of days.
The Navy Intelligence Office in Paris will correlate the data.
I'll review it after that. Paris? That's your old office, isn't it? Yes, Senator. Do you think that's where the Starflyer's agent is? It's a very high probability that one of them is there, yes. I was running several entrapment operations before I was dismissed. And I went and told them about Casimir, Justine said bitterly. Paula Mayo stared straight ahead at the cylinder containing the array. I will expose the Starflyer, Senator. That is what the Guardians are fighting for. The one thing Casimir McFoster believed in above all else. Yes, Justine said with a nod.
I have completed an analysis of the memory crystal, the RI announced. It holds 372 files of encrypted data. There are some software safeguards against unauthorized access, but they can easily be circumvented.
Good, Justine said.
Given the capacity of the array, she would have been very surprised if it couldn't gain access to whatever was stored on the crystal.
Can you decrypt the files?
They are encrypted with 1,280-dimension geometry. I do not have the processing capacity to decrypt that level.
Bugger,
Justine muttered. For a moment her hopes had actually risen. She had expected slightly more help from a piece of hardware that had just cost her over $5 million Earth dollars.
Who does?
The S.I., Paula said. And the Guardians, of course.
Justine asked the question that she found very difficult. Do you trust the S.I.?
In helping us defeat the Prime Aliens, I believe it to be a trustworthy ally.
That's a very cautious answer.
I do not believe that humans can understand the S.I.'s full motivation. We do not even know its true intent toward us as a species. It claims to be benign, and it has never acted in any other fashion toward us. However,
yes,
during the course of my investigations, I have come across instances which suggest it pays considerably more attention to us than it will admit to.
Intelligence gathering has been the occupation of governments since the Trojans got a real bad surprise from that little gift the Greeks left behind. I don't doubt for a second the S.I. monitors us.
But to what end? There are several theories, most of which belong to the wilder realms of conspiracy paranoia. They all tend to concern its incipient ascent to godhood.
What do you believe?
I imagine it considers us in much the same way as we would regard a mildly troublesome neighbor. It monitors us because it doesn't want any surprises, especially one which would threaten the neighborhood.
Is this really relevant?
Probably not, unless it chooses to take the side of the primes.
Damn, you're suspicious.
I prefer to think of it as an extended chess exercise, the investigator said.
Excuse me?
I try to see all the possible moves that can be made to oppose me as far ahead as I can. But I agree that the S.I. being an enemy is extremely remote. On a personal level, I have established a useful working relationship with it. And of course, it does contain a great deal of downloaded human personalities, which should act in our favor. Now I just don't know what the hell to think. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to place you under any additional anxiety. It was thoughtless of me, given your current situation.
You know, the only benefit of my age right now is that I know when I'm too messed up to be making that kind of decision. So if you don't mind, I'll just leave it up to you.
Do you want to ask the SI to decrypt this for us? The only alternative is to contact the Guardians and ask them directly. Do you know how to do that? Justine asked. No. If I had that kind of lead into the Guardians, I would have shut them down decades ago. I see. The grey-blue icon for the code Casimir had sent her hovered in the corner of her virtual vision, inert but oh so tempting. Once again, she knew she wasn't thinking clearly enough to make that choice. She didn't even know if she should tell the investigator she had it. And for a Commonwealth senator to contact what was currently classified as a political terrorist group was a momentous act. Instinctively, she was loath to risk loading that innocuous code into the Unisphere. If any such association became public knowledge before the Star Flyer was exposed, she would be completely discredited. Not even the family would be able to protect her, and the Star Flyer would have won another victory. We might not have to ask anyone to help with the memory crystal, Paula said. The Navy is investigating the observatory in Peru. They ought to be able to find out the nature of the data, even if the actual files remain blocked. Okay, then, Justine said in relief. We'll wait until the Navy files that report. She extracted the memory crystal from the array, then switched off the room's screening. Warm afternoon sunlight flooded back through the big windows, making Justine blink. The mansion's butler was waiting beside the door. Admiral Columbia is waiting to see you, ma'am, he said.
He's here?
Justine asked in surprise. Yes, ma'am. I showed him into the West Wing reception room and asked him to wait.
Did he say what he wanted?
Alas, no, ma'am.
Stay here. Justine told Paula. I'll deal with this.
She set off down the North Wing's central corridor, squaring her shoulders as she went. How typical of Columbia to try to gain the advantage by making a surprise visit to her home ground. If he thought that kind of crude tactic would work against even the most junior Benelli, he was badly mistaken. The decoration in the West Wing reception room harked back to the most lavish days of the French monarchy. Justine had always disliked quite so much gilt framing and gold leaf, and the period chairs, although beautifully ornate, were actually uncomfortable to sit on for any length of time. Admiral Rafael Columbia was standing waiting in front of the huge fireplace, one foot raised slightly to rest on the marble hearth. In his immaculate uniform, all he was missing was a fur-lined coat for the image of an imperial Tsar to be complete. He seemed to be studying the onyx case clock dominating the mantelpiece.
Senator!
He gave her a small bow as she made her entrance, pushing the double doors open and striding in.
I was admiring the clock. An original?
The door swept shut behind her.
I imagine so. Father is quite an aggressive collector.
Indeed.
Justine indicated a glass-topped table, etched with the Benelli crest. They sat down on opposite sides in high-back chairs.
What can I do for you, Admiral?
Senator, I'm afraid I must ask why you interfered with a Navy intelligence operation. Specifically, removing the body of a suspected terrorist from the scene of a crime.
I didn't remove anything, Admiral. I accompanied the body.
You arranged for it to be moved to a non-official facility.
Our family biotechnology facility, yes.
Where the autopsy was conducted under full official supervision.
Why, Senator?
Justine gave him an icy smile.
Because I have no confidence in Navy intelligence. I had just witnessed the entire surveillance operation fail catastrophically. I didn't want any further failures.
Casimir's body should provide the intelligence staff with a great many leads. From what I've seen so far, your department has proved remarkably incompetent. There are to be no further mistakes on this case, Admiral. I will not accept any excuses.
Senator, may I ask how you know Casimir McFoster?
We met while I was taking a vacation on Far Away. We had a brief fling. He then showed up here at Tulip Mansion just before the Prime attack. Naturally,
When he told me he was working for the Guardians, I informed Commander Hogan immediately. It's all on file.
What did he want?
A number of things. To convince me the Starflyer was real. To remove the customs inspection of all cargo traveling to far away. I refused.
So you weren't close then?
No.
I understand you were extremely upset by his death.
I was extremely shaken by it. I am not used to witnessing total death. No matter what his views and activities, nobody that young should suffer death.
Was the supervised autopsy your idea, Senator?
Yes.
I understand Paula Mayo also accompanied the body.
I have every confidence in Investigator Mayo. Raphael's expression tightened.
I'm afraid I don't share that confidence, Senator. The investigator is a large factor in the whole Guardian problem which Navy intelligence faces. I was surprised and not a little upset when I heard your family secured her appointment to Senate Security.
We were surprised you dismissed her from Navy intelligence.
After 130 years of no results, I thought it expedient.
Everybody in the Commonwealth knows about the investigator precisely because she does produce results.
To be frank with you, Senator, she's beginning to lose the plot. She accused her own officers of disloyalty. She was running external operations without clearance. She also began to show sympathetic tendencies toward the terrorists she was supposed to be pursuing.
Sympathy? In what way?
She said she believed in the Star Flyer alien.
And you don't?
Of course not.
Who killed my brother, Admiral?
I don't understand. You know it was the same assassin who killed McFoster.
Quite.
And McFoster was a Guardian.
Whoever that assassin works for, they are opposing both the Commonwealth and the Guardians. I believe that leaves you with a rather narrow field of suspects, doesn't it?
The Guardians have been involved with the black market arms trade for a very long time. As a group, those people tend to settle their arguments with extreme force. We believe this assassin works for one of the merchants involved.
And my brother just got in the way.
If an arms shipment was blocked, then a lot of money would be at stake.
This is ridiculous. Commonwealth senators are not murdered in some primitive vendetta.
Nor are they killed by invisible aliens.
Justine sat back and glared at the Admiral.
However unpleasant it is to acknowledge, Senator, Raphael said, the Commonwealth has a large criminal fraternity. That is why the original Intersolar Serious Crimes Directorate was formed. If you don't believe me, then feel free to ask Investigator Mayo. Or you might like to consider why Senate Security exists. We have enough problems with genuine threats to the Commonwealth. We really don't need to invent new ones.
Admiral? Are you warning me off?
I'm advising you that your current actions are inappropriate at this difficult time. Right now, we need to pull together and fight our very real enemy.
The Navy has my full support, and will continue to receive it.
Thank you, Senator. One last thing. The McFoster terrorist was on some kind of courier mission. We didn't find what he was carrying. She cocked her head to one side and gave him a blank smile.
Isn't that unusual?
Very, Senator. I was wondering if you saw anything while you accompanied him.
No.
Are you certain, Senator?
I never saw what he was carrying.
If he was.
I see.
Columbia's gaze never flickered. We will find it eventually, you know.
You didn't find the assassin afterward, did you?
It was a childish jibe. But Justine enjoyed it anyway, especially the way Columbia's neck reddened slightly above his uniform collar. Gore Bernelli and Paula Mayo were talking on the worn leather sofa when Justine returned to her day room. Her father's plain gold face reflected dapples of light that glinted on the pillars and floor, flowing around with any tiny movement he made. Justine activated the screening as she came in, cutting off the daylight.
That McFoster boy made you soft and sentimental, Gore said as soon as they were secure. You should have kicked Columbia's ass right into fucking orbit. In the old days, you'd have eaten them for breakfast. I can't believe any daughter of mine has turned into such a goddamned liberal wimp.
These are the new days, Father, Justine said calmly. And I'm not the one out of place and time. Inside she was seething that he'd say such a thing anywhere, let alone in front of the investigator. Even Paula Mayo, usually so composed, looked uncomfortable at Gore's outburst.
Just telling you the way it is, girl. If your dad boyfriend is fucking with your emotions, you should get your memory of him wiped out of your brain. I can't afford you to be weak. Not now.
I'll certainly consider eliminating anything I find distasteful from my life. She sometimes wondered if Gore was still human enough to remember and understand a concept like love. There had been so many adaptations made to his body.
That's more like it, he said, chuckling. You know, Columbia is going to come at you six ways from hell after the L.A. Galactic screw-up. He wants Paula here out of the picture permanently. And while he's at it, he'd like the Senate to turn into a nice little Soviet parliament, voting for him unanimously every time.
It's not Columbia you have to worry about, Paula said. Justine and Gore broke off their little contest of wills to look at the investigator. I believe I know the real reason Thompson was killed.
And you haven't fucking told me, Gore snapped.
For almost the entire time I was in the directorate, I lobbied for all the goods shipped to Faraway to be examined by police-style inspectors. It was blocked by the executive every time, until Thompson rammed the proposal through for me.
And the Starflyer killed him for it, Gore said. We knew that.
Just before he was killed, Thompson called me. He said he'd found out who had been blocking my requests. Nigel Sheldon. That can't be right, Justine said automatically. Sheldon made the whole Commonwealth possible. He's not going to try to undermine it.
Not voluntarily,
Gore said. Even with his golden skin making any normal expression impossible, it was obvious the notion troubled him.
But as I understand it, Bradley Johansson always claimed he was enslaved by the alien.
I've replayed the recording of Casimir's last minute in the Caralvo terminal several times now, Paula said. He appeared to know the assassin. In fact, he was delighted to see him. It was almost as if they were old friends. No. Justine shook her head, rejecting the whole idea. I can't believe anybody could get to Sheldon. The security our family has around us and at our rejuvenation facilities is phenomenal. Sheldon's will be even stronger.
The Guardians claim that President Doyle was working for the Starflyer, Paula said.
And what a load of crap that was, Gore grunted. If the Starflyer bastard can cut through Senate security and Sheldon's protection, it wouldn't need to skulk about in the shadows. It'd already be our Fuhrer.
Then why was your son killed? Paula asked. Just for implementing the cargo searches? Or because he uncovered the connection?
All right, Gore said reluctantly. Assume Thompson came across some information which made him believe it. Did he say who gave him Sheldon's name?
No. He said the whole area was very unclear. It was politics at the highest level.
Politics doesn't have a high level, Gore muttered.
He turned to Justine.
This is down to you. We need to find out where Thompson got his information.
Dad, I don't have anything like his contacts in the Senate.
Jesus Christ, will you stop selling yourself short, girl? If I want to hear whining that pitiful, I'll visit a human rights lawyer on Orleans.
She threw up her hands. Fine. I'll go blundering around shouting out questions in a loud voice and see if anyone comes to take a shot at me.
More like it,
Gore said, his metallic lips lifting in an approximation of a smile. To what end? Paula asked.
What do you mean, what fucking end?
What will you do if the Senator confirms it was Sheldon who has been blocking my requests?
If it's true, we'll need to go to his senior family members and show them what's happened. I expect they'll have him re-lifed and updated from a secure memory store that predates his corruption, whenever that was.
Do you think the Sheldon family will support you?
They can't all be Starflyer agents.
Indeed not. But how will we know which are?
We're being very premature, Justine said. Let's try and establish what we suspect first. After that, we should have a clearer picture of what to do.
We also need to create some reliable alliances, Gore said.
A kind of political resistance network to counter the Starflyer's influence. I'll make a start on that.
Watch out for Columbia, Paula said. Now he's aware you're my sponsor. He'll be gunning for your family as well. And his political influence is growing. Societies make a lot of shortcuts during wartime. As admiral in charge of domestic defense, he'll be able to issue orders that would never be countenanced in peacetime.
Don't you worry yourself about that. Hell would have to freeze over for a long time before some Halgarth stooge outsmarts me.
The little Boeing 44044 VTOL plane landed on the observatory pad amid a swirl of air from its electric jets, which stirred up quite a storm of sandy ochre soil and filthy ice granules. It fell away quickly as the fan slowed, and the flight attendant opened the hatch. Rennie felt her ears pop as the pressure dropped abruptly. They were 5,000 meters up in the western side of the Andes, just north of Sandia, with the rugged mountains forming a magnificent snow-capped vista all around her. Rennie immediately felt short of breath and sucked down a huge lungful of air. It made no difference at all. She got up out of the seat and scuttled forward, zipping up her coat over her thick sweater. The light outside was bright enough to make her pause at the top of the air stairs and put on her sunglasses. In the treacherously thin air, her breath formed little white streamers in front of her face. Two officers from the Lima Office of Navy Intelligence were waiting for her on the ground, wearing dark green jackets that looked more like spacesuits than severe weather gear. Getting down the 5 aluminum steps left her gasping for oxygen. One of the men came forward and extended his arm.
"Lieutenant Campuser, welcome to Antina Station.
I'm Phil Mandia. I was part of the team boxing McFoster on his way up here."
"Great," she wheezed.
She could barely make out his face behind a protective amber-tinted goggle mask. Her heart was hammering away hard inside her chest. They had to walk very slowly over to the observatory buildings, a line of squat boxes made from dark plastic, with windows like portholes. Only one had any lights on inside. The 3 main radio telescope dishes were sitting on the big rocky field behind the buildings, huge white saucers balanced on improbably thin spires of metal. As she watched, one of them turned slightly, tracking along the northern skyline.
"How's my prisoner behaving?" she asked.
"Coughlin. He claims he knows next to nothing, that he was on some security contract from an anonymous agent. For what it's worth, I believe him."
"We'll know for sure once I take him back to Paris."
"What are you going to do? Read his memories?"
"Yes."
Even with his face shielded by the mask, Phil Mandia's grimace of disapproval was quite blatant. Rennie's feet started crunching on the icy rime that bristled over the soil. There didn't seem to be any plants anywhere, not even tufts of grass. She had to be careful where she trod. The ground was creased with deep tire ruts that had frozen solid. The aging yellow-painted vehicles that had made them were parked outside around the buildings, looking like a disreputable crossbreed between tractors and snowplows. A pair of new maroon Honda 4x4s was drawn up beside them, sides splattered with thick brown mud.
"You came in those?" Rennie asked.
"Yeah."
Phil Mandia nodded at the single bleak road winding away from the observatory.
"It was a brute of a drive up here."
"How the hell did you manage to avoid being seen by McFoster?"
"With difficulty."
Rennie wasn't sure if he was joking or not.
They reached the main building and went inside, where the world was warm again. It didn't make any difference to Rennie's heart, which was still racing away. She had to sit heavily in the first office they came to. There was no way she could get up again, so she had to take her coat off while remaining in the seat, a simple act that made her even more out of breath. She couldn't think how she was going to get back out to the VTOL again. The others might have to carry her.
"Doesn't this altitude bother you?"
she asked Phil Mandia.
"Takes a while to adjust," he admitted.
Rennie was beginning to realize how the local team resented her. Some big-shot exec sent up to check on why the operation had crashed, looking to shift the blame onto a field team. "It's not like that," she wanted to say. But that would make her look weaker in his eyes. Office politics she could handle easy enough.
"Okay, let me start with the director," she said.
Jennifer Seitz was only 5 years out of rejuvenation. A small, trim woman with attractive green eyes and very dark skin, she wore a baggy chestnut-brown sweater that was long enough to qualify as a dress. The sleeves were rolled up, but even that didn't stop them flapping around her thin arms. Rennie decided it had to be borrowed from someone else, about half a meter taller. The director seemed irritated by the Navy's invasion of her observatory, rather than intimidated or worried. Her forceful, dismissive attitude was outwardly softened by the beguilingly youthful smile that she could produce. Phil Mandia received an exasperated glance as he politely ushered her into the office. Even that came over as mere petulance rather than genuine disapproval. Rennie pointed at the room's circular window and the three big dishes outside.
"Which one," she paused, took another breath, "is pointing at Mars?"
"None of them," Jennifer Seitz said. "The major dishes are for deep space radio astronomy. We use one of our ancillary receivers to pick up the signal from Mars. It's not a huge operation."
"And are we sure it's the Martian data which Coughlin supplied to McFoster?"
Rennie glanced at Phil Mandia for confirmation.
"There's no trace of any of it left in the observatory network memory," the Navy officer said. "Coughlin loaded a trace worm program to eliminate any record of the transmissions right after McFoster picked up the copy."
"There must be other copies," Rennie said.
"How long have you been receiving the data?"
The corner of Jennifer Seitz's mouth produced an involuntary tick. "About 20 years.
20? What the hell have you been doing with it?"
"We collect it for a science research association. It's a very minor contract for us. Less than 1% of our overall budget. It doesn't even require human supervision. Our RI can handle the whole process. The signals come in once a month. We receive them and store them for the association. Their project length is expected to be 30 years.
Jennifer Seitz caught the surprise in Rennie's eyes.
"What? You think that's long term?
We're running some observations here that will take a century to complete. That's if we're lucky."
"Okay, back up a moment here and take me through this slowly," Rennie said. "I didn't even know the Commonwealth had anything on Mars. Where do these signals come from exactly?"
"The remote science station on Arabia Terra."
"And what sort of science goes on there?"
"Just about the full range of planetary science. Remote sensing, meteorological, geological, I should say aerological, solar physics, radiation. It's a long list. You name the subject and it'll have its own set of instruments up there busy watching. They're all over Mars, relaying their readings to Arabia Terra, which in turn sends them to us. Satellites, too. There's 4 of them currently in polar orbit, though they all need replacing."
"I never knew anyone was still interested in Mars."
"Very few people are," Jennifer Seitz said sardonically. "We're talking astronomy here, after all. Even after Dudley Bowes came along, we're not exactly the most popular profession in the Commonwealth. And there are planets in this universe a lot more interesting than Mars. However, a small collection of sensors operating over a long time can produce just as much data as a shorter, more intense study. Actually, the data is more relevant when gathered over time, more representative.
We have remote stations right across the solar system, collecting little chunks of data and sending them back to us and the other observatories in a steady drip. Most Earth universities or foundations tend to have some small department for each solar body. They all struggle along on minimum resources, cataloguing and analyzing their information. But the instruments they use don't cost much by today's standards. They're all solid-state, and either solar or geothermal-powered. They last for decades. Between them, they supply just enough information to keep Earth's few remaining planetologists in business. I'd like a list of them, please. The association which funds the Martian station is based in London. The Lambeth Interplanetary Association, I think. God knows where they get their grants. I mean, pure science planetology in this day and age. You've got to be a real science philanthropist to support that. What exactly is the project which the Lambeth Interplanetary Association is paying for? I've no idea.
You don't know?
Rennie said it so loudly. She had to take a fast breath to refill her lungs, which made her cough. She could feel a headache growing behind her temple. Not my field, Jennifer Sight said. Strictly speaking, I'm a radio astronomer. I work with the main dishes. They're part of the Sol-wide array. Our baseline is Pluto orbit, which gives us one hell of a reception capability. It's also why we have a lot of ancillary receivers here, to keep in touch with the Sol-wide units that are really far out. So you see, I have not the slightest concern in dust on Mars, or tidal ice fracture patterns on Europa, or the geoshell superconductor currents on Charon. Now, if you wanted to know about truly interesting events like Big Bang emission rebounds or mag quasar squeals, then I can entertain you for days on the subject. Is anyone here a planetologist? No. All we've got here are two radio astronomers. That's myself and my partner, Carrie, and four technicians to keep everything running smoothly. Well, as smoothly as something as underfunded as Solwide can be kept running.
And just to add to the richness of our lives, since the Prime attack, the UFN Science Agency is actually talking about shutting us down for the duration.
I've got to produce proposals to mothball the whole observatory. I should have shoved this whole astronomy kick into a secure memory store at my last rejuve and come up with an interest that makes me filthy rich. I mean, who the hell's interested in supporting people who'll quietly dedicate several lives to help expand the general knowledge base of the human race? Not our goddamn government, that's for sure. Now I've got you people jumping all over us.
I'm sorry about the observatory, Rennie said sharply. But there is a war on. The Commonwealth has to prioritize.
Yeah, right. So has the Lambeth Interplanetary Association actually seen any of the data you were receiving for them?
No.
Mars accounts for nearly half of the remote monitoring projects in the solar system. Their timetables are measurable in years. Admittedly, 30 years is quite long for planetary science, but not exceptional. What kind of sensors were transmitting from Mars?
Exactly.
Jennifer Seitz shrugged.
I checked the contract when the shit hit the fan, of course. It doesn't tell us much. The instruments we were recording just provided a generalized overview of the Martian environment.
Could you have been receiving encrypted signals in with the rest of the data?
Sure.
I don't know what from, though. Do you at least have a list of the instruments up there?
Yeah.
But, Lieutenant, you have to understand, we didn't place any of them on Mars. Some were already there, left over from earlier projects. The rest have been deposited over the years by the UFN Science Agency's automated ships. We have no control over them, no supervisory role. I cannot give you an absolute guarantee what any of them actually are. Simply because we've been told a specific channel in the data stream carries the results of a seismic scanner doesn't make it that in reality. It could equally well be information on Earth's defenses for an alien invasion fleet. There's just no way of knowing for sure, other than going there and checking the transmission origin in person.
All we are is a glorified relay node.
Rennie didn't like getting distracted, but
there are automated spaceships working in the solar system.
You didn't know that?
No,
she admitted.
Well, Lieutenant, there have to be. It's like this.
None of us in the heady world of astronomy or solar planetary science can afford to hire a CSD wormhole to drop a thermometer into Saturn's atmosphere. Instead, we swallow our pride and group together. That way we coordinate our budgets to produce instrumentation in batches. When a batch is ready, we load up one of the science agency's 3 robot freight ships with our precious consignment of satellites and sensors and send it on its merry 8-year tour around the solar system. Then each and every one of us selfishly prays that the damn antique doesn't break down before it drops off our own particular package. Tip for you, Lieutenant. When you're in the company of Earth's astronomers, don't ever mention the 2320 placement mission. A lot of colleagues left the profession after that minor catastrophe. It takes, on average, 15 years of applications, proposals, review procedures, outright begging, and signing away your firstborn to get a sensor project approved. Then all you have to do is find the funds to design and build it. There's an awful lot of emotional and professional investment riding away in that cargo bay.
Yes, Rennie said defensively. Her headache was now pounding away inside her skull. She was sure she'd brought a packet of teefy. It was probably in her jacket pocket, hanging up several meters away, too far for her to walk.
Thank you, I get the picture.
Yours is not an overpaid celebrity occupation.
Not unless your name is Bose, no.
So, to conclude, you have no idea what you've been receiving from Mars for 20 years.
Jennifer Seitz gave an apologetic smile.
That's about it. Although I'd like to go on record as saying I've only been director here for 7 years, with 2 years absent for rejuvenation. I didn't take the contract, and none of us were involved with it. The whole thing is run by a couple of subroutines in the RI.
Who did begin the contract?
Dr. Rowell was in charge when the Lambeth Association began the project. I think he moved to Birkhack. He was offered a dean's post at a new university.
Thank you. I'll have him questioned.
Rennie sucked down more thin air. The lack of oxygen was making her feel lightheaded. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation, but her thoughts were sluggish.
Tell me something. In your opinion, what could possibly be on Mars that would interest a bunch of terrorists like the Guardians?
That's the really dumb thing about this.
Nothing.
And I'm not being prejudiced because I'm a radio astronomer. The place is a complete dump, a frozen, airless desert. It has no secrets, no value, no relevance to anybody. I'm still half convinced you people made a mistake.
Then tell me about Coughlin.
Jennifer Seitz screwed her pretty face up.
God, I don't know.
He was just a technical assistant, a mundane time-serving tech working in a piss-poor science agency job to pay his R&R pension. Up until yesterday, I would have sworn I could have told you his entire lives stories better than he could. And incredibly boring they all were, too. We all spend 3 weeks on duty crammed together up here, for which we get one blessed week off. He was actually assigned here 3.5 years ago. So I don't like to think how much time that means we've spent living, sleeping, and eating in this very same building since then. Now it turns out he was part of some terrorist plot to take over the Commonwealth.
Jesus!
He's Dan Coughlin. 7 years short of rejuvenation, and desperate for it to happen. He loves curry, hates Chinese food, accesses way too much softcore TSI soap, had one wife this life which ended sour, visits his one child grandkid every year at Easter, his feet smell, he's a second-rate programmer, an average mechanic, and drives the rest of us nuts, practicing tap dancing. Badly.
What the hell kind of terrorist enjoys tap dancing?
Bad ones, Rennie said dryly.
I can't believe he did this.
Well, it certainly looks like he's guilty. We'll confirm that for ourselves, of course. I expect you'll all be called as witnesses at the trial.
You're taking him with you?
I certainly am.
Somehow, Rennie managed to hobble her way back to the VTOL plane without being too obvious as she leaned up against Phil Mandia. Two Navy officers escorted Dan Coughlin onto the plane behind her. He was pushed down into a chair on the other side of the aisle from Rennie. Malmetal restraints flowed over his wrists and lower legs, holding him secure. Not that he looked as if he'd make a break for freedom. Jennifer Seitz had been right about that. Coughlin, a tall man who had managed to avoid becoming overweight, was very obviously approaching the time when he needed a rejuvenation. Worry and a defeated air made his cheeks and eyes seem excessively sunken, with flesh that was as pallid as Rennie's. Being dressed in a pair of worn dark blue overalls simply helped to complete the whipped underdog image. He looked out of the small window as they took off, a bewildered expression in place as the observatory dropped away below. Rennie's headache had started to fade as soon as the hatch was shut and the jets began to pressurize the little cabin. She opened the vent above her seat and smiled contentedly as the filtered air blew over her face. A coffee from the stewardess eased away the last of the discomfort, without any need for a teefy tube. "The flight should take about 50 minutes," she said, and turned her head toward Coughlin. "We're going to Rio, then a loop train to Paris." He said nothing, his gaze fixed on some spot outside the window as they climbed into the stratosphere at a steep angle. "You know what's going to happen when we get there?" she inquired lightly. "You walk me past a warm judge and shoot me." "No, Dan. We'll take you to a Navy biomedical facility where you'll have your memories read. By all accounts, it's not a pleasant experience. Losing control over your very own mind, having other people invade your skull and examine any section of your life they want. Nothing is private. Your feelings, your dreams. We rip them all out of you." "Great. I always had an exhibitionist streak." "No, you don't." She sighed in a sympathetic manner. "I accessed your file. I've talked to your workmates. What are you doing mixed up in all this nonsense?" He looked over at her. "Your interrogation technique is crap. You know that. I'm not an experienced spook like you, Dan." "Very funny. I'm not a spook. I'm not a terrorist. I'm not a traitor. I'm none of those things." "Then what are you?" "You read my file." "Remind me." "Why?" "All right. The bottom line is this. Cooperate, spill your guts and your heart out to me, and I might recommend we don't bother with a memory read. But your story had better be a damn good one." "And my trial?" "I'm not cutting you a deal, Dan. It doesn't work like that. You go to trial, whatever happens. But if you help us, then I'm sure the judge will take that into consideration." He took a minute, but eventually gave a soft nod. "I have a grandson, Jacob. He's 8. "Yes?" "I had to go to court to get access to him. Damn it, he's all I've got left from this screw-up of a life, the only decent thing anyway. It'd kill me not to be able to see him." "Have you got children, Lieutenant?" "Some, yes. None this time around, yet. But they all have children. I'm a great-great-grandmother these days. And do you see them all? Your family? When I have the time? This job, you know. It isn't a 9-to-5. But you get to see them. That's what counts. My daughter took her mother's side. And we're all native Earthborn, that's the problem. You need to be a millionaire just to get an appointment with a lawyer on this planet. And I'm not. So someone offered you some money. Enough for a lawyer to get you access."
"Yeah.
Who?"
"I don't know his name. I never met him.
He's just an address code in the Unisphere. He's an agent for people in the personal security field. A friend told me about him. Said he might be able to help me."
"Okay. The friend's name?"
"Robin Beard."
"So this agent recruited you?"
"Yes."
"To do what?"
the way he put it, virtually nothing. I was worried I'd have to kill somebody. Probably would have done it too. But all he wanted was for me to apply for the UFN Science Agency technical maintenance job out at the observatory. I had to monitor the Martian data they were receiving, make sure there were no problems. He said that one day somebody would come and collect a copy of it, and when that happened, I was to erase the original. That was it. All I had to do.
And for that, I got to see little Jacob again, once a year at Easter.
It's hardly a massive crime, so I figured, what the hell? All right, Dan. Now this is the really important bit. Do you know what that data was?
No.
He pursed his lips as he shook his head.
No, I swear.
I tried looking at it a couple of times. I mean, it was obviously valuable to the agent, but it just looked like ordinary remote station data to me. Did you make your own copy, Dan? Maybe try for a bit of leverage?
No.
I got to see my Jacob, like they promised. So I played fair with them. I didn't think they're the kind of people you should try and cross. I guess I was right about that. You said they're terrorists. The answer vexed Rennie. She had a nasty feeling he was telling the truth. Dan Coughlin wasn't criminal enough to try a little spot of blackmail on his own initiative. Just a weak, desperate man, easy to exploit, if you knew which buttons to press. And who was ever going to be looking for some sleeper in a radio telescope observatory in the middle of the Andes? Whatever the Guardians had done on Mars, they'd made a damn good job of covering their tracks. Until someone murdered Casimir McFoster. A day later, she was still puzzling over how that killing fitted into an otherwise watertight operation. The Paris office was investigating the case on a 24/7 basis, backed with the highest Navy priority. Nobody in accounts was going to question budget or timesheets on this one. Late morning, she caught herself yawning as her console screens pulled up yet another sequence of information on the elusive Lambeth Interplanetary Association. There was only so much coffee she could take to counter the fatigue toxins accumulating in her bloodstream. It was another grey Paris spring day outside, with rain running down the windows. Inside, her colleagues were getting cranky from lack of sleep and frustration at the loss of the assassin in L.A. Galactic. There had been more than one argument shouted between desks that morning, and no one's humour had been soothed by a report on their office being heavily featured on the Alessandra Baron show. The beautifully poised presenter had taken particularly malicious delight showing how the murderer had struck his victim down while surrounded by Navy intelligence officers before making good his escape. She also hinted that the L.A. Galactic killer was wanted for questioning in connection with the Bernelli murder.
"Where does she get this?"
Tarlow had growled.
"That's classified."
"The Bernelli family, probably," Rennie said. "I don't think we're terribly popular with them right now. After all, that was Justine's toy boy that got slaughtered. She's probably angling for the case to be turned over to Senate security."
Tarlow lowered his voice, glancing around guiltily in case anyone else overheard. "I found out while you were away in South America. The boss is receiving all our data as and when we file it. Hogan's been going quietly crazy knowing she's watching everything over his shoulder."
"Finally," she murmured. "Some good news. Has she contacted you?"
"Not yet. You?"
"No."
"If she does, tell her I'll help her any way I can."
"Will do." They parted like a couple having an illicit office romance, both trying not to smile. Commander Alec Hogan arrived back at the Paris office just after lunch. He was in a bad mood. He knew he was in a bad mood. And he knew being in a bad mood was bad for a decent office environment. Frankly, he didn't give a shit. He'd just got back from Kerensk, where he'd spent an hour in Admiral Columbia's office, trying to explain the L.A. Galactic fuck-up, the Admiral's personal description. He knew of no reason why he shouldn't spread the misery. Everybody in the big open-plan office looked up from their displays as he came in. He caught quite a few smirks that were hurriedly smothered.
Senior officers, progress meeting in conference room 3, 10 minutes, he announced as he stomped through into his own office. There were muttered comments behind him, which he didn't bother with. Alec settled into the chair behind the desk, the kind of ordinary black leather office furniture a secretary would have. It was left over from Paula Mayo's tenure, and he hadn't got around to replacing it yet. Like everything in the office, including the people. He took advantage of the solitude to rest his head in his hands, making an effort to dump his emotional baggage and focus. Taking over the Paris office had been such a huge opportunity. The Navy was growing at a phenomenal rate, and he was on the inside track, moving up fast. Attaching himself to Columbia's staff had been the smartest thing he'd ever done back in the days when it was the Directorate. He'd done a lot of troubleshooting for Director Columbia, filing reports on nearly every division. It made him an automatic choice to keep an eye on Paula Mayo after Reese left. Now he could finally appreciate what she'd been up against all those decades. Christ, is this how Mayo felt for 130 years? The way the assassin had eluded them at LA Galactic wasn't so much amazing as downright insulting. And judging by how his escape route was so immaculately planned out, he had to have known the Navy was observing McFoster. Which implied there really was a leak somewhere. The one thing Alec could never tell the Admiral, not until after he had absolute proof, and preferably a full confession as well. There was also the extreme problem of exactly who the assassin was working for. The most obvious conclusion, the one Mayo had settled for, was politically impossible. He could never admit that to anyone. The idea was career suicide. He simply had to get the whole Guardian situation under control, report some solid progress to the Admiral. If there weren't any results, and fast, he'd be following Mayo out the door. And he was pretty certain nobody would be offering him a cushy job in Senate security. On the plus side, the fallout from LA Galactic had produced a good range of leads into various Guardian operations and personnel. His Paris officers were good, despite the bitterness left from Mayo's forced departure. All he had to do was ensure they had the resources to complete their various investigations and coordinate a decent strategy for the overall case. There would be results that would cut deep into the Guardian's operation. There had to be. Alec drank down a full glass of mineral water, hoping it would calm him and get him into the right frame of mind to chair the meeting. Maybe he was just dehydrated. It had been a hectic 24 hours. When he was ready, he headed for the conference room. Rennie Campasau was in front of him, carrying a tall mug of coffee. Tarlow and John King were already waiting inside. John had been an investigator in the old Directorate, moving over from the Technical Forensic Department a couple of months before the administrative changes began. The timing of that move meant he wasn't quite as frosty toward Alec as the other two senior lieutenants. "Too much caffeine," Tarlow said loudly as Rennie sat down. "That's what? You're 8 this morning." She glowered at him. "I either drink this or I start smoking. Your call." John laughed at the shocked expression on Tarlow's face. Alec Hogan went in and sat at the head of the white table. "The Admiral is not pleased with us at all," he told them. "A fact which he made very clear to me, as I'm sure you can appreciate. So, somebody please tell me we have finally got a name for our assassin."
"Sorry, Chief," John King said. "His face isn't on any database in the Commonwealth. It's a reprofile job, of course. We've probably got him under his old identity. But his current features are completely unknown."
"Not so," Rennie said. "McFoster knew him. In fact, he was glad to see him. Overjoyed, actually. For my money, our assassin is from far away."
"Who on far away is going to send an assassin into the Commonwealth?" John asked.
She shrugged. "Don't know. But at the very least, we should check CST's records to see if he came through the Boongate station in the last couple of years."
"All right. I'll get my people on that," John said.
Foster Cortese is running visual recognition programs for me. He can add the Boongate database to his analysis.
Good, Alec said. Now what about the equipment he was wet-wired with? We all saw what he was capable of. That stuff was cutting edge. There has to be some sort of record.
Jim Nguyen is following that up for me, Tarlo said. There are plenty of companies across the Commonwealth who manufacture that kind of armament. I didn't realize. A lot of it is supplied to grand families and intersolar dynasties for their security divisions. Tracing the end user through them is difficult. They're not being very cooperative. Then there's always Illuminatus. The clinics there are even less friendly.
If anyone blocks you, let me know right away, Alec told him. The Admiral's office will apply some pressure directly.
Sure.
Right, Rennie, what did you turn up at the observatory?
Quite a lot, though I'm not sure how much of it is relevant.
Let's hear it.
She sipped at her coffee, wincing at how hot it was. First, we confirmed what McFoster collected, a whole load of data that they'd been storing. Apparently it all came from Mars.
Mars?
Alec frowned.
What the fuck is on Mars?
That's where we start running into problems. We don't know. The data was transmitted from a remote science station. Officially, it was a project sponsored by the Lambeth Interplanetary Society to investigate the Martian environment. The station has been transmitting the signals for 20 years, supposedly from automated sensors dotted all over the planet.
Did you say 20 years?
Yeah, she said sardonically. However, the Lambeth Interplanetary Society no longer exists. It went virtual 8 years ago. Today it's just a named address, logged with an equally bogus legal firm. There's an administration program overseeing a bank account with just enough money deposited to pay for the Mars project to its conclusion. The observatory gets its annual fee, and if anyone calls the society with a query, the program has a menu of stock replies. In other words, it's a typical Guardian's front operation.
Was it ever real?
Alec asked.
When it was set up, yes.
There was a physical office in London, along with staff. I've got Gwyneth trying to track down anyone who was employed there. We're hoping to turn up a secretary or some junior staff member. It's not promising. Anyone important would be a Guardian. The rest would be off-worlders on a standard employment visa. As there aren't any records, we're checking with off-world employment placement agencies. Why did the Guardians abandon the Society office if the Observatory is still collecting data for them? John asked.
The switch coincides with the last set of instruments being sent to Mars, Rennie said.
They paid for a lot of packages to be deployed in their first 12 years. You can't do that entirely through the cybersphere.
There have to be meetings. Actual people to talk to the UFM science agency staff and take them out to lunch, attend seminars, designers for the sensors, packages, that kind of thing.
So there are records of what they shipped out to Mars. Alec didn't like the implications of how big the Guardian's operation was, nor that it involved something new, something they couldn't understand. That was too many negatives to file in any report to the Admiral.
We have UFN Science Agency manifests for their transport ships, she said.
As to what was actually placed on board at the time, there is no way of knowing. Those ships travel all over the solar system, and the planetary instruments they deploy are packed in secure containers inside one-shot landers. Nobody at Lunaport would ever break open a sealed system as they load it on a ship. There's no reason.
You're telling me that the Guardians have been running an operation here in the solar system for 20 years right under our noses, and we still don't know what it is?
Alec stopped. He didn't want to come over as critical. They had to work together on this.
What about other planets?
Are the Guardians running operations on them?
It doesn't look like it, Rennie said.
Matthew Oldfield is running verification on all the solar planetary projects the UFN Science Agency knows about. So far, they look legitimate. It was only Mars.
But there's no way of knowing what they placed there.
No, short of physically visiting and inspecting the equipment.
But the systems have been returning data for 2 decades, and were scheduled to continue for another 10 years. I can't see that they'd be any sort of weapon. To be honest, I don't see that it's worth wasting any more of our resources on. Whatever it was, the whole project is obviously over.
I can't agree with that, Tarlo said. They've been running this for 20 years. It's got to be important to them. That means we have to find out what it was.
It was the data which was important, Rennie replied. That's what they were after. And now it's gone.
Coughlin wiped the observatory memory, and McFoster didn't have it on him when he was killed.
Alec didn't like the reminder that McFoster appeared to be carrying nothing, although that whole issue was blowing up into a big political fight between the Admiral and the Bernellis. He certainly didn't want to drag the Paris office into that, and he could almost agree with Rennie about Mars being a waste of their resources to chase up. But 20 years. Johansson had obviously thought it extremely important.
What about this Coughlin character? Have we had a memory read off him yet?
I don't see the point, Rennie said. He told me everything voluntarily on the flight back to Rio. We pumped him full of drugs here, and he repeated the same story. He was just a paid accomplice. He's not big time. My recommendation is charge him with criminal conspiracy and let the court sort out what happens next. If you don't think he's any more use, then fine. Alec told his e-butler to make a note.
He did produce one useful name, Rennie said.
Robin Beard. He was the intermediary who put Coughlin in touch with the anonymous agent who set up the whole deal. Now, this is only a hunch, but several of the team involved in the assault on the Second Chance were recruited through an agent who specialized in security operatives and who also was very careful to remain anonymous. Could be coincidence, but they were both Guardian operations.
Do we know where this Robin Beard is?
Alec asked. He tried not to seem too excited. That would be unprofessional, but the agent did sound like a very promising lead.
I've got Vic Russell working on it as a priority. Last known address was on Cagayan. Vic's on the express out there now. There's a liaison with local police already set up.
Excellent.
What about Mars?
Tarlo asked.
We can't just ignore it.
Well, here's the interesting thing, Rennie said. Coughlin never transmitted anything to Mars through the observatory link. No coded instructions to shut down. So in theory, the remote station and whatever the Guardians placed there is still operating. It'll send another signal in 8 days' time. The UFN Science Agency is putting together a group of planetary scientists to analyze the data for us and see if it is from environmental sensors.
8 days? Tarlo said scathingly. Come on! Commander, they were desperate for this data. We have to investigate this now.
Alec wanted to agree, but the cost of actually sending a forensic team to Mars would be phenomenal. Diverting a CST wormhole, even an exploration division one, would cost millions. That kind of procedure would have to be authorized by the Admiral.
Why can't the observatory get in touch with the Mars remote station today? There must be some kind of communications protocol to run diagnostics on the systems up there. It's got to be cheaper, probably quicker, too.
Rennie gave a shrug. I suppose so. I can ask Jennifer Seitz, the director.
Do that. Let me know.
He smiled in satisfaction. Good, clean decisions. Proper leadership. Everyone profited.
Sure.
She took another sip of her coffee.
Some good news for you, Chief, Tarlo said.
He shot Rennie a malicious smile across the table.
Go.
We're making headway on McFoster's financial data records. I need a warrant to open his accounts at Pacific Pine Bank. They're guarded. Once we can study his spending pattern, we can draw up a profile of his movements. We'll also find out where his money came from.
One-time account, cash deposit, Rennie said, and grinned over the top of her mug. They always are.
untraceable.
Tarlo showed her a stiff finger. You'll get the warrant in an hour, Alec promised. All right, this isn't as bleak as it looked back there in the junction. We can crack this. I know we can.